Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I don't often get an opportunity to interact with philosophers and psychologists around this particular theme. My interest is in multimodality. I think that was perhaps one of the reasons why I was asked to kind of participate in this workshop. So I'll try and explain a bit more about multimodality, and in particular my perspective on multimodality, because the first thing to say about multimodality really is that that concept may be all the rage now. It's a term that comes up everywhere, but it's being defined in quite different ways. There's quite a lot of variation or diversity rather in terms of the theories and methods that people bring to explore multimodality. In a book that we published last year called Introducing Multimodality, we have made that as one of our starting points really, and we've sort of tried to explore what the key differences are in those different perspectives on multimodality. And in that book, we only really selected three perspectives that are actually still relatively similar, although they do have some fundamental differences. They include conversation analysis, social semiotics, and systemic functional linguistics. So we just started out with that set of three, and we tried to map out in what ways these three approaches are different and similar. But we obviously acknowledge in the book that there are all these other approaches to multimodality as well, and we're very much aware of that. So I think these days, when you talk about multimodality to explain your work or your interest, you really need to explain what that framework is that you work in order to avoid confusion. So what do I think is multimodality about? How would I define that? Well, for me, multimodality is related, first of all, to the notion of mode, which may seem obvious, but actually it isn't, because lots of colleagues do use the term multimodality, but they don't really use the term mode. Now, I do. For me, mode is defined as a socially and culturally shaped set of resources that we use to express meaning. And so examples of modes might be speech, or gesture, or image, or writing. And I do then also acknowledge that we've only just started to think about exactly what that list looked like. It's not actually easy to come up with a list of modes that are in operation at some point in an instance of communication. But they're working assumptions and working definitions. So that's that. So mode for me is a central concept. And if you compare modes, then you can also try to work out what the distinct affordances are of each of these modes. So I would always assume that what you can do with speech is slightly different from what you can do with writing, for instance, or with gesture. But there are also commonalities in terms of how these resources are used to achieve certain things. So if you think about intensity, you will find that we've got resources in speech, such as loudness, to realize intensity, but we've also got resources in gesture, different kinds of resources, also to achieve or realize intensity, such as the extent or the speed of movement that we use in a gesture. Similarly, in typography, if we want to realize intensity, we can increase the weight of the font, for instance, to do that. So it's those kinds of differences and similarities I think are important to attend to. Then The next point is related to the idea that as media makers we draw on that range of different resources precisely because each of these resources by themselves are partial and incomplete. So we cannot but bring in a range of different resources to make meaning and to communicate. And Chuck Goodwin, who works in the tradition of conversation analysis, has put this very eloquently in, I think, what is now a classic paper from 2000, where he says that when joined together in local contextures of action, diverse semiotic resources mutually elaborate each other to create a whole that is both greater than and different from any of its constituent parts. So I very much like that idea, and it's also related to terms like multimodal ensemble, which it has been used in the tradition of social semiotics. That's more or less what I regard as sort of basic working assumptions. We can add more to this list, but this is enough for now. And this may seem not all that controversial until you actually think about what that means for all the terms and all the definitions of, for instance, language. So if you adopt multimodality in the way that I just outlined, then you have to reject the idea that language is the single most powerful mode, full stop. Yeah, that would be a statement that you just can't make. And so you would have to reject what otherwise very interesting people like Roman Jakobson have said many years ago, that language is the central and most important among all human semiotic systems. You know, those kinds of statements we would now question, or at least I would now question. Also, I would now no longer use terms like paralinguistic or nonverbal, because they then also seem to reproduce that idea that language is always primary and all these other things are sort of secondary. So if you adopt the notion of multimodality, then for me that means that you then also move away from these older terms like paralinguistic features or non-verbal communication. And equally, I don't think it's quite helpful to describe all modes as language. This is another response you sometimes get when you talk about multimodality, that people say, well, yes, but doesn't all of that form part of language anyway? Can we not just be more inclusive in our definition of language? And I would say no, because of the distinct differences of these modes of communication. And if they're different, then I think it's also helpful to give them a different name, just to remind ourselves of that. So it is actually quite a radical shift in thinking about communication and the role that language plays in that. Multimodality is more than just another term or a repackaging of old ideas. It really is marking a shift in our thinking where we're trying to move away from taking language as the starting point of everything. In my own work, one of the domains where I've done quite a bit of research is in clinical communication, in particular in recent years in operating theatres, video recorded operations. And one of the many reasons why that was a very interesting site for me to look at was because there you have an activity that is organized around some kind of practical task. And so you will see people communicating in ways that are quite different from what you might see in the conversation that we are all very familiar with, and that linguists have always been drawn to anyway. So there is a kind of an assumption almost that if you're interested in communication, then the conversation is the most obvious place to go to. In fact, if you go to these operating theatres, you will find that people do also converse, in that they may have a little chat about what they saw on TV the night before, but also, and in fact most of the time, they don't talk at all, and yet they communicate, because they need to coordinate their actions. They can't really work in isolation there. That's why they've got a whole team of people gathered around a patient. One person needs to hold a retractor, the other person needs to hold a camera, yet another person is holding all sorts of graspers. And to ensure that all these actions sort of add up and are in sync, they need to actually read each other's bodies and each other's actions very carefully and respond to that in all sorts of ways. And so that's one of the things that I was particularly interested in exploring when I had gathered up some data there. So to give you an example, in this line drawing on the left hand side, you see an assistant holding a scissors, and she cuts a tie that's held by a consultant. And the consultant was tying knots, was tying up a vessel, and he had thrown, as they call it, about six or seven knots. And at that point, he sort of held the tie up like this, and the assistant responded to that particular action by cutting the thread somewhere in the middle. And that's, in a sense, a very a basic structure that we see here, of a prompt being given, a response then follows from someone who interpreted that prompt as indeed a request, in this case, that this assistant was expected to respond to. There are other things that I explored in this example as well. One key issue there being how that assistant actually managed to get hold of the scissors just in time for making that cut. Because she didn't actually have scissors in her hand. As usual, these things come from scrub nurse, who is located close by. So you can see that assistant actually turning towards the scrub nurse to make the request for the scissors, then turning back to the operative field whilst waiting for that scissors, then again turning to the scrub nurse to receive the scissors, and then actually having that scissors on standby, and literally a couple of seconds before that cut is being made. So all of these things happened very smoothly and seamlessly in this case, but if you slow down and make transcripts like this, you can begin to work out the ways in which these participants use their body to signal to others around them what they're up to, what sort of course of action they are pursuing, and of course that's a very critical resource in this context. People need to constantly anticipate what colleagues will be doing next. Along very similar lines, I looked at interactions also between surgical consultant surgeons who supervise trainees. These trainees at some point get to hold the scalpel, which of course is the most invasive instrument. It's instruments that you can use that can harm the patient as much as doing good work. And so what you see there is surgeons having to again interpret those actions of the operating trainee very, very carefully, and you can see how they interpret those actions if you look very carefully at what they say. I try to explore that through transcripts like this. So on the right hand side you see a basic transcription of what the consultant was saying. Just be a bit careful with the planes there. There are ureters and things. I'd go superficially, yeah, as you're doing. That's the right plane. Now, of course, if we just look at what's being said here without looking at the actions that were performed by the trainee, it doesn't make sense at all. They are entirely entwined. And if you then try to map those utterances onto a timeline, and you then also try and map these instrumental actions on the same timeline, you can begin to see how one becomes a response to another. And in this case, I try to mark out these instrumental actions by making a distinction between contacting, grasping, lifting, and cutting, which may seem like it's actually not that complicated. What you see, if you look very carefully at these video clips, is an instrument approaching a tissue plane. So that's the first thing I marked, which is called contact. Then sometimes you'll see that that's then followed by grasping a little bit of tissue. So you just have to imagine some kind of grasping instrument with sort of jaws at the end that you can use to pick something up. And so that is then sometimes done, and sometimes a little bit of tissue is picked up like that, and then lifted, which is the next step, so it's sort of stretched out. And then the next step is to actually cut that tissue. And so that cut is, of course, the most crucial bit, so you want to see how that's negotiated, those tiny little cuts. So through transcript like this, I explored those issues. Now I won't say more about the surgical context because we're here today to talk about public debate. But it is, I think, useful to see and explore those less common activities because they do really remind us of some of the very basic principles that we use in communication. And so to try and make a bridge to the issue of public debate, communication in different kind of settings, I'll just say very briefly a few words about a clip that we looked at in great detail with colleagues at King's College for a summer school that we've been running for almost 10 years now. And we've got this little clip from a job interview that was originally part of CEO Roberts and Sarah Campbell's work. They had been looking at job interviews in a delivery company, and this particular interview is with a temp, so she's currently working there in that delivery company as a temp, and they somehow ended up talking about some of the recent changes that this company went through more specifically to change from the 2 deliveries per day to 1 delivery per day. And the issue now is, the question that he was asked now is, what did you hear people around you say about that particular change? That's of course a tricky a question, where there are issues around, you know, who do you align yourself with? Do you align yourself with, you know, your colleagues on the shop floor, who may have expressed some complaints or may have raised issues with that change, you may not be happy with that change, and then yet here we are faced with representatives of the senior management of the company. So we explored one clip in great detail from that job interview, and the one of the utterances that we looked at was this. At some point, in response to that question, the candidate says, the walks have doubled. And then after 1 second, one of the interviewers says, some. Yeah, so that was one utterance that we looked at. And you can see some of the details that we added here in the transcription, in terms of vowel lengthening, the stress that's being put on doubled, but also the pitch contours, which are not insignificant here, because this utterance is not closing anything off. It's sort of keeping things a little bit open. It says, the walks have doubled, and it goes up a little bit, as if something else may follow. Okay. Now, I then looked at some of the other features that are particularly relevant here in more detail, such as eyebrows. We can see the candidate raising her eyebrows at the beginning of this utterance, and as she says walks, her right hand lands on the table. So it's this stroke that coincides with walks. The walks have doubled, and as she says have doubled, again, her hands land on the table. This time it's both her hands that land on the table, and it looks as though she's sort of trying to visualize doubled by doing something like this. Doubled, and then doubled again coincides with the lexical item doubled. Then we get this 1 second silence, in which her eyebrows drop again, but she holds her hands in that very same position. They're fixed in that post-stroke position. And then at some point she starts smiling a little bit. And so what you see here is how this candidate is almost demanding a response from the interviewer at this point. In thinking about what does some mean? Was that an intervention by the interviewer, who was sort of correcting her? Excuse me, no, you're wrong. It wasn't. You know, the walks hadn't doubled. Only some had doubled. It was a solicited response, as we can see from all these features. Of course, the other sort of more general issue here is that you can see how signs are made in different modes, and they are connected to form these kinds of ensembles in the way that I mentioned at the beginning. So that's just a little illustration of how a multimodal perspective can shed a different light on what happens during, for instance, a job interview, but I think it's not a huge jump from here to looking at the TV interview that we will be looking at later today. where and that these those features will also come up. I've got a couple of sort of closing comments or issues that are worth reflecting on when it comes to analyzing video recordings of this kind. Of course, we need to consider what the material is that we're looking at, how it was produced, what kind of frame we've got, what kind of angle was adopted, and was it the researcher who made those kinds of decisions, or was it a TV production company who made those decisions? That's important to bear in mind. And of course, when it comes to developing interpretations, how do you know? I suppose one of the advantages of video, of course, is that we can orient to the observable orientations or responses to prompts. We can see how people interpreted the preceding actions, and that's, I think, quite crucial and different from, for instance, discussing how people make meaning in an interview, where you reflect on some kind of event that you haven't made recordings of. There are lots of issues around transcription, of course, about what is to be included, what is to be excluded, and what's to be foregrounded, and so forth. And that's especially critical because, of course, in linguistics we've got this long tradition of making fairly detailed transcripts of what's being said, and we've got sort of conventionalized ways of doing that, whereas with these other modes of communication we don't really have any sort of conventions, so we need to basically invent our own transcription system. And of course that transcription system needs to match the sort of multimodal makeup of the events that you are looking at, and you may not necessarily want to put the transcriptions of speech first. You know, that may not need to be in the first column, it may need to be in the second column, or it may not be the first line, depending on how you organize your transcript. But it really, the multimodal perspective really forces us to also entirely rethink how we transcribe. So that's just a couple of issues that I think will come up as we start talking about the TV interview clip later on today.
Thank you.